to stream for free on YouTube in the United States. And that about wraps up this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour. This program covers the week of May 16th, 2021. My name is Bill. Thanks for joining us this week. This program, presentation, whatever, as always, comes from Mind's Eye Radio in Belleville, Illinois. You all have a good week. Stay in, stay safe, stay dry. That's a little bit challenging this week. And please rejoin us next week. We'll have more interesting information for you. Until then, see you, bye.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Western Magazines, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 80 and mostly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the May issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The Best of the West. This edition of CNI's Best of the West takes you on a history-rich tour of sorts. You'll travel to Ohio's Serpent Mound with a contributor and his daughter. You'll learn about the struggles and triumphs of 19th century Northern Paiute author, activist, and interpreter Sarah Winnemucca. And you'll discover a dozen expertly curated classic books for your library that provide immersive takes on eras past. We've also sprinkled in previews of historic anniversaries and wise words from a few inspiring groundbreakers. To know where we're going, we have to know where we've been. Dig in and dig deep. Making the Rounds of the Ancient Mounds. A road trip reveals the mysteries of Ohio's ancient native earthwork sites and the father-daughter bond. By Matt Crossman. The hill climbs high in front of us. A misty rain and the low clouds it's coming from covers the hill and everything else my daughter and I can see in gray. The trees that surround us on either side where we're walking stand like stark skeletons, bleak against the sky. We hear only birds, as if the mist swallows all other sound. Finally, we arrive at the top of the hill, home to Serpent Mound, perhaps the most intriguing site among dozens of Native American earthwork locations across southern Ohio. It gets its name from the dominant feature here, an effigy mound in the shape of a snake eating what appears to be an egg. To crest the top of the hill is to enter a sacred place. My daughter and I stop to survey the site. Ahead is the welcome center, closed. To our right is a burial mound, so small we almost miss it. The serpent is to our left. We approach the tail first. It spins a few circles as if to gain momentum, then curves back and forth, making a shape like an M with an extra hump. We walk alongside it on a paved trail. The serpent to our left, the hill sloping down to a forest to our right. We say little. What is there to talk about in such a place, except the mystery of what the serpent is and what it's doing? We can't solve it, and we don't try. Our silence reflects the wonder and curiosity that has washed over us, a feeling that Nancy Stranahan, a natural historian and director of the Ark of Appalachia Preserve System, which manages Serpent Mound and manages and or owns other earthwork sites in the region, still feels after years of visiting here. Whatever this place is, whatever the snake represents, we know, instinctively, it demands reverence. Even if, as Stranahan puts it, I don't know what to be reverent about. My daughter and I walk toward an overlook. The sound of highway traffic reaches us and snaps me out of my reverie. At first, this noise annoys me. I was enjoying communing with this place. If I observe it silently enough for long enough, maybe it will reveal its secrets to me. But now I think of the highway noise as connective tissue spanning history and cultures. My daughter and I have come to Serpent Mound on a road trip, and while Native Americans who stood atop this hill hundreds and even thousands of years ago would not have heard the hum of rubber on pavement or the growl of internal combustion engines, they certainly would have known that others were coming and going from here. Not only did Serpent Mound draw travelers from across the region, but other mound sites nearby attracted pilgrims from across the continent. Road tripping, the most American of vacations, allows freedom, the most American of values. With cars, we can come and go as we please. At the very least, travel is easier when there's no pressure to make flights or stress because of change or cancellation fees. In the age of COVID-19, we need the flexibility car travel offers more than ever, as states, cities, hotels, museums, etc. open and close. Sometimes, like with this trip, flexibility pushes the bounds of my patience. For reasons I won't bore you with, I had to change my destination, my accommodations 3 times, the people who would go with me also 3 times, and the dates, lost count. As frustrating as all that was, the beauty of the open road is that it's there when you're ready. When I finally climbed behind the wheel of a 2021 Yukon AT4 that GMC gave me for the week, my 14-year-old daughter rides shotgun. Pro tip, if your 14-year-old daughter asks to road trip with you, you say yes. Normally, when my wife and I take our 2 kids on family road trips, we rent mid-sized cars and preemptively winnow our packing list down, because otherwise we'd cram a zillion things into the trunk and back seat and forget to leave room for people. Knowing this, my 14-year-old pulls out her charmingest, doe-eyest look and tries to sweet-talk me into letting her bring extra pillows. There are no space issues, honey. Bring whatever you want, I say. The last time I road-tripped like this, I drove a Chevy Bolt EV. I could have put that in the Yukon's glove compartment and still had room for the manual. Kidding about that, but not this. The Yukon is so big, I have to rearrange my garage to fit it in. I'm normally a bare-bones car guy. I don't care about or use a DVD player or Wi-Fi or whatever. But the navigation system on the Yukon works where my phone's GPS does not. That will prove helpful all week, in visiting mound sites and nature preserves, coffee shops and dairy bars. We drive for hours and put hundreds of miles on country mountain roads in areas with no cell service. Automotive nerds will appreciate, as I have come to, the Yukon's multicolor head-up display. It projects key information, speed, speed limit, distance to the next turn, etc., onto the corner of the windshield so I don't have to take my eyes off the road, which proves especially valuable in the mountains at night. The steep inclines and sharp turns I'm negotiating in the Ohio River Valley are easier to handle with the rig's air ride adaptive system, which adjusts the suspension to the conditions. Flexibility indeed. The time-warping contrast of the tricked-out vehicle I'm piloting and the ancient mounds I'm visiting keeps striking me. the mysterious mound builders who left evidence all over the Ohio River Valley of their sophisticated civilizations, would have no idea what to make of me and my high-tech world. I have no frame of reference to make sense of them and their lives, either. When Serpent Mound was excavated in the late 1800s, it yielded no answer as to its age or who constructed it. There are three burial mounds on site, two by the Ardenia people, 800 BC to AD 100, and one by the Fort Ancients, AD 1000 to 1650. There is also evidence that people from both cultures lived atop the hill, albeit to different degrees. Since that initial excavation, evidence has been discovered suggesting each of those cultures as the source of the mound. Archaeologists have debated, without coming to a resolution, which one is correct. Brad Lepper, senior curator of archaeology and manager of archaeology and natural history at the Ohio History Connection, which owns the site, makes a convincing case in favor of the Fort Ancients, but he won't call his arguments definitive. He says the snake might be the retelling of an old tradition known as the Degila Suan creation story, which is depicted in Picture Cave in Missouri. That scene is strikingly similar to the Serpent Mound and is from the same time frame as the Fort Ancients. In the story, Picture Cave tells, the first woman, also known as Old Woman Who Never Dies, has intercourse with a snake known as the Great Serpent, Lord of the Beneath World, and derives the power to create humanity from the snake. Lepper suggests Serpent Mound tells the same story. The serpent stretches 1,348 feet across the top of the hill. Covered in grass, it's well cared for. We arrive at the head, which has a wide-open mouth eating an egg. Lepper says the egg is a reconstruction and might be a misinterpretation by an archaeologist in the 1880s. On the other side of the egg, the hill drops off to the creek below. This overlook suggests an answer to one question, why here? Even on a rainy winter day, an ethereal beauty radiates across the property. Humans have lived in this area many centuries. Then, as now, the ground is fertile, the weather is mild, the water is abundant, and the animals are plentiful. If you had skill, this was Eden, Stranahan says. So it's not a big mystery that they picked a nice flat hilltop surrounded by Brush Creek. It was for communication to spirits. What a nice place to put it. That's true of many of the mound sites in Ohio, particularly Fort Hill Earthworks and Nature Preserve. Popular with birders and hikers, the preserve covers 1,300 acres, 12 miles north of Serpent Mound. The trail to Fort Hill climbs 493 feet through a rocky, mature forest. A light snow falls as my daughter and I dig our boots into the hard ground. We huff and puff as we follow a 2.8-mile loop trail. Built by the Hopewell culture 2,000 years ago, this mound is a hilltop enclosure shaped like a triangle. The mound runs 8,619 feet, or more than a mile and a half. Compared with a snake slithering across a lawn, the Fort Hill earthwork is subtle. Trees grow out of it. Looking through a thick forest, I had to study to make sure it was a mound and not just a natural contour of the hill. It varies from 6 feet to 15 feet high, averages 30 feet in width, and encloses 35.3 acres. The name Fort Hill is a misnomer. It wasn't a fort. It was probably a ceremonial gathering site, though what kind of ceremonies took place here is unclear. Built into the wall are 33 gates, entrances and exits to get in and out of the enclosure. Following a trail through those entrances and exits, my daughter and I enter and leave the enclosure. We seem to be miles from the next human. The isolation transports me in time. I feel alone, disconnected from the rest of the world, like an island far out in the ocean with no way to communicate with the outside world, or desire to, for that matter. I'm content looking at those entrances and wondering what they gave access to. My daughter and I arrive at Hopewell Culture National Historical Park in Chillicothe, Ohio, 41 miles northeast of Serpent Mound, on a brisk afternoon. The reverence that swallowed us at Serpent Mound and the location that narrowed my attention at Fort Hill are lacking here. With a prison across the street and a subdivision behind the park, it's hard to lose yourself here. But just as traffic noise was appropriate at Serpent Mound, so too are hustle and bustle here. In and around Chillicothe, there are more mounds and earthworks than anywhere else in the world. This place must have been busy when the Hopewellians built it in 2,000 years ago, so it's hard to be upset if it's busy now. Hopewell Culture National Historical Park comprises six sites. Mound City Group, which we tour, has at least 23 mounds in 13 acres contained within a rectangular enclosure. Two other mounds stand outside the enclosure. Many other separate mound sites are close by. 60 miles north from Chillicothe is Newark Earthworks, the largest set of geometric earthen enclosures in the world. Dr. John Lowe, a citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi, associate professor in Ohio State's Department of Comparative Studies, and the director of the Newark Earthworks Center, says it's important to note that the mounds were built by persuasion, not force. The fact that they were made of dirt and not stone or any other material, reflects how important they were. Earth is the most sacred material, Lowe says. We could have used rock if we wanted to, but we used the most sacred material available to us. When archaeologists examined mounds in Chillicothe and Newark, they discovered copper mined from Lake Superior, 600 miles north. There was obsidian from Yellowstone, 1,700 miles west. There were grizzly bear teeth from the Rockies, 1,400 miles west. There were shells from Gulf of Mexico, 800 miles south. In that era, Ohio produced Flint Ridge flint. If trade made with other Native American cultures brought copper from Lake Superior, obsidian from Yellowstone, etc., historians expect those areas would have Flint Ridge flint. But the amount of Ohio material found in those locations has been minimal, according to Lepper. If trade didn't bring goods to the Hopewells, what did? Why is there so much stuff in Ohio? This is like standing in Jerusalem and saying, "Why Jerusalem?" Lepper says. But in this case, you don't have the Bible. Or standing in Mecca and you don't have the Koran. I think something special happened here. There was some person, a Moses, a Mohammed, a Buddha, who had some special message that resonated with people for thousands of miles. Without having those things recorded, you can't say what that message was. Somebody fired the imaginations of people to do these great things. We don't know his or her name. Lowe says it's likely that person was the same one who persuaded Hopewellians to build the mounds in the first place. It could have been a great orator, or prophet, or storyteller. It might have been more than just one, he says. It may have been several generations. It might have been a group. Think the Beatles or the Stones and how they shook the world. Even now, the power of that person still stretches across the centuries. As my daughter and I drive home, I think of little else but those mounds, who built them and why. Whatever the person's name, Leper and others are working to secure their place in history. The Hopewellian sites and Serpent Mound have both been nominated to become World Heritage Sites, which would put them on the same level as some of the most famous destinations in the world. We're saying these sites aren't just important for Ohio, Leper says. They're not just important for the United States. The Native American achievements here are no less important than the Great Pyramids of Egypt, Stonehenge, the Great Wall of China. That's how important we think these sites should be treated. I don't know how much the importance of what we've seen together resonates with my daughter. As we drive the hours south from Ohio toward home, we mostly ride in silence. It's a pleasant silence. She plays on her phone some, looking up from it to talk every now and then. There are no daddy-daughter epiphany moments, but I know from experience that trying to create those does not work. Our moment was not having a moment, if that makes sense. Instead, this is a mile down the road of life on a journey that never really ends. As the miles rack up on the Yukon and we get closer to home, the ancients begin to recede a little into the gray mist. But I won't forget them or this trip, and I hope my daughter will remember it fondly. I think she will. I know I will.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine, published May 2021. On the Santa Fe Trail, 1821 to 2021, by Johnny D. Boggs. The bicentennial of the National Historic Trail is a great reason to hit the road and rediscover why it is the West's original mother road. When you get right down to it, almost every trail ever blazed was for profit. Despite all the glory associated with them, the lure of money was behind the Chisholm Trail, first for trade goods, then for selling longhorns in Kansas, and the California and Klondike trails to find gold fields, and the like. The Santa Fe Trail, on the other hand, never even thought about fame. It was all about money. Says James A. Crutchfield, the Owen Wisterer Award recipient for lifetime contributions and author of On the Santa Fe Trail, probably the most important legacy of the Santa Fe Trail is its role as the oldest overland trail in the Trans-Mississippi West, in contrast with other extended trails which primarily served as roads of immigration, the Oregon and California trails, for example. The Santa Fe Trail was first and foremost a highway of commerce. West from Franklin, Missouri. That commerce began 200 years ago when William Becknell pulled out of Franklin, Missouri in September 1821, bound for New Mexico. In a notice published in the Missouri Intelligencer, Becknell said he was forming a party to travel westward for the purpose of trading for horses and mules and catching wild animals of every description. It wasn't exactly a wise business decision, but more of a giant gamble, or at least a crazy leap of faith. Mexico had been under Spanish rule, and the Spaniards had closed the border to any trade with Americans. But with Mexico having declared its independence, Becknell's party headed west through Indian country and the parched Great Plains and rugged Southwest. When they reached New Mexico, they weren't imprisoned, but welcomed. It proved a profitable venture. Becknell made a 200% profit. The Santa Fe Trail was off and running. Few stories in westward expansion eclipse that of the Santa Fe Trail in terms of pure adventure or in the profound impact on the growth of the nation, says Deb Goodrich, chair of Santa Fe Trail 200 and Garvey, Texas historian in residence at Fort Wallace Museum in Wallace, Kansas. The 1,200-mile trek, when the mileage from all the routes is counted, saw commerce and conflict, conquest and subjugation. It saw fortunes made and lost, lives buoyed and busted. What had been a highway between nations became the lifeline of an ever-expanding United States. The National Historic Trail. Those 1,200 miles connect five states: Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, New Mexico, and the trail was designated a National Historic Trail under the National Park Service in 1987. Today, there are 900 historic trail sites. Becknell's journey began in Franklin, which was washed away by the Missouri River, but the jumping-off place can be viewed from the other side of the river in Boonville. New Franklin replaced Old Franklin in 1828, and monuments can be found on the town's main square. With pack mules loaded with trade goods, Becknell and his party followed the wagon road established in 1816 to the ferry at Arrow Rock State Historic Site, then took the Osage Trace through Lexington, Battle of Lexington State Historic Site, where James and Robert Owl started outfitting traders bound west in 1822. Due west lies Sibley, where the reconstructed Fort Osage National Historic Landmark illustrates what had been the westernmost army outpost and a profitable fur factory. It wasn't on the Santa Fe Trail, Crutchfield points out, but that's where the government survey of the Santa Fe Trail started in 1825. Independence, Missouri. More important in Missouri was Independence, Independence Courthouse Square, Woodlawn Cemetery, which took over for Franklin as the primary departing point for merchants and also marked the beginning of the Oregon Trail. Westport Landing, now part of the metropolitan Kansas City, eventually replaced Independence as what Crutchfield calls the last official beginning for the Santa Fe Trail. Kansas City has absorbed much of the trail, though the camping site at Archibald Rice Farm is now part of the circa 1844 Rice Tremonti home in Raytown. Wide spot in the road, National Frontier Trails Museum and Library. Missouri was the jumping-off point for more trails than the one to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the National Frontier Trails Museum, ci.independence.mo.us, covers the Santa Fe and more, from Lewis and Clark to the Pony Express to the Transcontinental Railroads, but the focus shines on the Santa Fe, California, and Oregon trails. The Independence Museum also houses a library named after Merrill J. Matz, 1910 to 1996, co-founder of the Oregon-California Trails Association that includes more than 2,600 first-person narratives. Good Eats and Sleeps. Good Grub, a little barbecue joint, Independence. Good Lodging, inn at 425 Kansas City. Kansas. The trail entered Kansas, and many merchants stopped in what is now Fairway to take advantage of the facilities, a blacksmith shop, at the Shawnee Indian Mission, now a state historic site. Near present-day Gardner, the Santa Fe Trail kept west, and the Oregon Trail turned northwest. Ruts can still be seen east of Baldwin City on a self-guided tour at the Robert H. Pearson 1890 Farmstead Home. On June 2, 1856, those ruts came in handy during the Battle of Black Jack. Members of John Brown's Free State Militia and Henry Clay Pate's pro-slavery forces looking to avenge the Pottawatomi Massacre of May 24th through 25th fought for 3 hours, and both parties used the ruts for cover. There are new walkways at the site and signs to interpret the events that occurred there. Goodrich says, "I never visit without feeling the energy, the very spirits of those who clashed here." Just west lay the Narrows, as ridge wagons used to avoid draws, often filled with mud and tough terrain. Blue Mound, alias Wakarusa Buttes, roughly 3 miles south of Lawrence, served as a landmark for merchants and wayfarers, and then came a series of crossings. Switzler Creek and Dragon Creek, near Bullingame, and Soldier Creek, about 1.5 miles west. Near Soldier Creek on Kansas Highway 31 is the grave of Private Samuel Hunt, a dragoon serving with Colonel Henry Dodge, who died in 1835 while returning to Fort Leavenworth with Dodge's Rocky Mountain Expedition. After around 10 days of traveling from Westport Independence, the traders would stop at Council Grove, which offered more than just a respite at the Last Chance store, and today is a must-stop for Santa Fe Trail aficionados for the Post Office Oak, Council Oak, Last Chance Store, Kaw Indian Mission, and Hayes House Restaurant. In 1825, Kaw Indians signed a treaty that allowed traders safe passage as they journeyed to or from Santa Fe. But the Kaws paid a price, says Goodrich. In 1873, the Kaw Nation was moved from their lands along the Santa Fe Trail and relocated to the Indian Territory, now Oklahoma. The very state that took its name from the tribe booted them out to take the lands along the trail. Since then, the Kaws have incrementally come home, purchasing back some of their ancestral lands and holding sacred events on the ground. Reclaiming their homeland is an ongoing process for the Kaw Nation. Theirs is just one such story that played out on the trail and continues to unfold. From there, the trail continued west, Diamond Spring, Lost Spring, Cottonwood Crossing, and to familiar places for Western buffs like Fort Zarah in Great Bend, Pawnee Rock, Fort Larned, check out the Santa Fe Trail Center in Larned, and Fort Dodge in Dodge City, Boot Hill Museum. West of Dodge at Cimarron, Becknell made an executive decision on his 1822 trek back to Santa Fe. On this trip, Becknell had brought three wagons, 24 oxen, and 21 men. But he thought that wagons would not be able to get through the Raton Pass on the Colorado-New Mexico border. It's not always easy in a car today. Wide spot in the road, San Sage Bison Range and Wildlife Area. Finding a bison range in Kansas shouldn't come as a surprise, but a national forest? Both can be found at the 3,760-acre San Sage Bison Range and Wildlife Area, ksoutdoors.com, near Garden City. The forest began in 1905 when the 30,000-acre Garden City Forest Reserve was established on a trial basis, then grew by almost 275,000 acres in 1908. Although the project failed, surviving trees can be found today. Bison, however, have endured since being reintroduced in 1924. Good Eats and Sleeps, Good Grub, Hayes House Restaurant, Council Grove, Central Station Bar and Grill, Dodge City. Good Lodging, The Wolf Hotel, Ellenwood, Sunnyland Bed and Breakfast, Garden City. The Cutoff. The Cimarron Cutoff followed the Cimarron River southwest, cutting through a portion of the Oklahoma Panhandle. Camp Nichols was founded by Kit Carson in 1865, and into New Mexico at Clayton, where the Rabbit Ears served as a guidepost, despite not looking at all like Bugs Bunny. The Cutoff saved 100 miles in 10 days, but it wasn't easy. When the land wasn't dry, it was filled with quicksand. Indians, including the Jicarilla Apaches, Comanches, and Kiowas, weren't pleased with white men traveling through their country. Near Point of Rocks, between Clayton and Springer, Jicarillas ambushed a caravan in 1849, killing most of the party, and kidnapped Ann White, her infant daughter, and her servant. Kit Carson served as a scout for an army patrol and tracked down the party, but White was killed. The Jicarillas escaped, and the infant and servant were never found. Wide spot in the road, Cimarron Heritage Center Museum. Hope died the first time people laid eyes on Boise City, Oklahoma, Timothy Egan wrote in The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. It was founded on a fraud, but today The Oklahoma panhandle town that took a beating during the Dust Bowl is home to the Cimarron Heritage Center Museum, which covers everything from dinosaurs to the Dust Bowl and includes restored buildings and exhibits on the Santa Fe Trail. And there's free admission to boot. Good Eats and Sleeps, Good Grub, Blue Bonnet Cafe, Boise City. Good Lodging, Branding Iron Bed and Breakfast, Boise City. Colorado. The mountain route entered Colorado east of Granada and continued west to Lamar, Big Timbers Museum, Madonna of the Trail, through Las Animas and Bent's Old Fort near La Junta, Otero Museum. Founded in 1833 by William and Charles Bent and Seren St. Vrain, the adobe compound was the only permanent Anglo settlement between Missouri and New Mexico. The Spanish Peaks near Walsenburg served as another beacon for travelers, and south of Trinidad, Trinidad History Museum, came Raton Pass. After Uncle Dick Wooten completed his road improvements across the pass, many travelers who previously preferred the Cimarron cutoff reverted to using the mountain branch of the Santa Fe Trail, Crutchfield says. Wide Spot in the Road, Boggsville. In 1866, Thomas Boggs finally got around to establishing Boggsville, one of the first permanent Anglo settlements in Colorado's Arkansas River Valley. But Zebulon Pike camped here 60 years earlier, and other travelers, including Kiowas and explorer Jacob Fowler, passed through too. After Boggs built the settlement, good friend Kit Carson became a neighbor in 1867. Carson was buried in Boggsville beside his wife, Josepha, in 1868, but their remains were reinterred in Taos, New Mexico. Today, Boggsville Historic Site, BentCountyHeritage.org, includes the homes of Boggs and John W. Powers. Good Eats and Sleeps, Good Grub, Jack and Wanda's Tasty House, Holly, Copper Kitchen, La Junta. Good Lodging, 3rd Street Nest Bed and Breakfast, Lamar, Tarabino Inn, Trinidad. New Mexico. The trail continued through Cimarron, Aztec Mill Museum, and Rayado, Kit Carson Museum, past Fort Union National Monument near Watrous, near Las Vegas and Pecos, and finally ending at the plaza in Santa Fe, New Mexico History Museum. The Santa Fe Trail proved good for business. In 1822, trade hit $15,000. In 1860, it was more than $3.5 million. Thus, from a political standpoint, the advent and pursuit of trade along the Santa Fe Trail fared well for both countries, Crutchfield said, at least until the beginning of the Mexican-American War. Wide Spot in the Road, Pecos National Historical Park. The Santa Fe Trail began in 1821, but Pecos National Historical Park, NPS.gov, about 40 minutes southeast of Santa Fe, follows history that started thousands of years earlier. This story begins with the ancient Pueblo Indians and moves on to include the Pueblo Revolt of 1680-92, Santa Fe Trail, Mexican-American War, and the Civil War, where soon-to-be Sand Creek butcher John Chivington won glory for the Union at the Battle of Glorieta Pass in 1862 and into modern times. Good Eats and Sleeps, Good Grub, Charlie Spick and Span Bakery and Cafe, Las Vegas, The Shed Restaurant, Santa Fe. Good Lodging, The Eklund, Clayton, Hotel St. Francis, Santa Fe. Johnny D. Boggs' latest novel is Matthew Johnson, U.S. Marshal. Now here's another story related to the Santa Fe Trail published in the May 2021 True West edition. The Santa Fe Trail beckoned the Mostey Brothers. by Kenyon Bennett. Two Kansas City boys hiked the famous road west in 1874 to make their mark in the cattle trade. The Santa Fe Trail, a vital commercial route, developed international trade between the United States and Mexico, fostered commerce on the plains, served as a military road, and contributed to westbound expansion in the United States. William Becknell and five men, desiring a profitable outcome, began a momentous journey September 1, 1821, from Franklin, Missouri, and in November reached Santa Fe, in what was then northern Mexico. Becknell's venture was lucrative, and commerce significantly increased along the Santa Fe Trail, which evolved and divided into the Cimarron and Mountain routes. Many smaller feeder routes arose from the wagon ruts left alongside strategic waterways, one being the Arkansas River that flowed across the plains. In 1874, the Santa Fe Trail fervently beckoned Albert F. and Leander A. Lee Mostey as they responded to the West's wild call. Before them had come William Bent and John Wesley Prowers, who had heightened commerce on the trail in earlier decades. In the early 1830s, Bent, St. Vrain and Company built Bent's Fort, or William's Fort, on the United States side of the Arkansas River in what is now southeastern Colorado. Sorens St. Vrain and brothers Charles and William Bent were partners, as indicated in a January 6, 1831 letter from St. Vrain to Bernard Pratt and Company. Generating much trade among trappers, fur traders, explorers, and plains tribes, Bent's Fort began operating around 1833. The Cheyenne and Arapaho were regulars. The fort became a major trading destination on the Santa Fe Trail. By 1849, Bent, St. Vrain and Company had dissolved, leaving William the sole owner of Bent's Fort. Sometime between August 16th and 21st, 1849, William blew up his trading post. Cholera outbreaks, broken negotiations for the sale of the fort to the U.S. Army, or a rumor that the military was going to confiscate the fort, possibly motivated Bent. Enough structure remained within the ruins for a stagecoach station to emerge a decade later, but by the early 1880s, the old fort served as cattle corrals, emphasizing the cattle industry's market development. Bent built a new trading stockade at Big Timbers during the 1850s in the lower Arkansas River Valley, where the Cheyenne and Arapaho traditionally wintered. This area was part of the mountain route. Just west of Bent's new fort, the U.S. government built Fort Wise, later renamed Fort Lyon, which operated from 1860 to 1867. The government also leased Bent's new fort. After a severe flood damaged Fort Lyon in 1866, the second Fort Lyon was built near Las Animas in 1867, which the U.S. Army first occupied in 1868. Any viable government fort required livestock and produce, and Prowers filled those needs. Prowers worked for Bent from 1856 to 1863 and regularly used the Santa Fe Trail to lead supply wagons from Missouri to Bent's new fort in Fort Union, New Mexico Territory. Prowers brought cattle west in 1861. After leaving Bent, Prowers worked as a sutler at Fort Lyon, and from 1865 to 1871, freighted government supplies between Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and Fort Union. He bought land, increased his cattle herd, and oversaw his farming. By 1873, he was a partner in Prowers and Ho, a busy commission house in West Las Animas. When Albert and Lee Mostey answered the West siren call during the spring of 1874, the two knew the Santa Fe Trail was an important route. Lee, almost 23, and Albert, only 19, made a pact. "We will hike off into the Great West and grow up with the country. We will remain together. We will stick together like wax. We will never part." Lee resigned from J.E. Forbes & Company Hardware in Kansas City. Albert quit the Olathe Rolling Flour Mill in nearby Olathe. Albert wrote and sketched in his monthly journals throughout the journey and the remainder of 1874. Before heading west, Albert purchased a sombrero. Peacock proud, he strutted and waited for Lee at a railroad depot in Kansas City. Some of the policemen didn't like the looks of me. My hat signified business. While Lee was there, one old bugger came up and rapped me with his billy, Albert wrote. The momentous adventure began. Albert and Lee visited older brother Frank in Butler County, Kansas, and then traveled to Wichita, a cow town. From there, they tirelessly hiked northwest along the Arkansas River and then west behind the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, AT and SF, tracks in Kansas, which roughly followed alongside the Santa Fe Trail. During a late afternoon in May, Albert and Lee perched on a fence by the AT and SF depot in Great Bend, Kansas. Two men walked up from the Arkansas River and into the depot. A third man approached the brothers and sat on the fence. I saw a howling John sticking out behind when the two men came out of the depot and went down the steps of the sidewalk, Albert wrote. The man on the fence jumped down and yelled, "Stop!" The two men turned around. "What do you want?" one asked. "You swindled me out of $10. "Liar," the two men responded. "Lay down that money. Lay it down on the sidewalk. Lay it down right now." "Go to hell," one of the accused shouted. Albert recorded the gunslinger's actions. So he aimed and shot. The fellows got a good start before he got a shot. They ran a good ways past. He shot at one, then at the other. He shot one in the body and arm, and the big fellow in the leg and foot. The big fellow, when he was hit in the leg, fumbled away and looked around several times, and then got underway again. They had been gambling. After the man got done shooting, he walked around the depot, reloading his pistol. The gunslinger briefly searched for the wounded men, but returned alone. He then galloped his horse swiftly through town, fired his pistol into the air, and yelled, "Like the devil," Albert wrote. The gunman wanted to let folks know he wasn't afraid of the whole town. Upon reaching the AT and SF terminus in Granada, southeastern Colorado Territory, in late May, Albert and Lee hiked the Santa Fe Trail's mountain route. The brothers walked 15 miles and entered a cowboy camp, where friendly cowboys offered them good bread, good coffee, and good buffalo steak. The brothers spent a night at the welcoming camp, continued their journey, and reached the most beautiful valley on the Arkansas River. There were groves of trees, then more trees, and more trees, Albert wrote. Unbeknownst to the brothers, they had begun walking through big timbers, an area with massive cottonwood trees and valleys on the Santa Fe Trail. To the west lay Las Animas. The brothers reached Las Animas, not to be confused with newer West Las Animas. Capricious chance intervened. Albert and Lee bought goods in McMurray Brothers General Store and met Nick Eaton, a stockman from nearby Mud Creek. Eaton needed a seasoned cook and additional drovers to help him drive Texas cattle north. The brothers asked to work for him, but Eaton said he would only hire one greenhorn and left. "He would give only one of us a job. That let us out. We would not part," Albert remembered thinking. Albert was wrong. The next day, Lee headed north with Eaton and the Texas cattle. Lee regularly drove large herds of cattle up the trails from Texas to Kansas for Eaton before becoming an independent cattle buyer and trader. Lee died in 1917. What about Albert? Prowers, now an influential and wealthy stockman, trader, merchant, and an 1873 territorial legislator, hired Albert one day after Lee's departure. Albert would become a cowboy and later a foreman for the large Prowers Ranch, which had cattle, horses, and sheep. With John Carter as head foreman, cowboys in designated camps worked the vast range. While settling into his new life on the Prowers Ranch in June 1874, Albert herded a large flock of sheep on the bluffs near the Johnson Ranch at Kadoa, about 20 miles east of Los Animas. He recorded that he had killed a big snake and seen a coyote and a black eagle. The sheep herded like racehorses. Guess they traveled as far as 10 miles. I couldn't stop them, no way, the astonished youth wrote. Albert's August 1874 journal referred to grand election days, disorderly activities in Bent County. Men known as Smith and Mexican John had accompanied Albert to Los Animas, having been elected county seat again in 1872. Albert indicated the three were besieged by political hucksters. And here they came. I thought about 40 of them. I looked around for Smith and he was gone, and all. All hollering here. Here's your ticket. And every one that could get hold of me was pulling at me to come his way. Every one was electioneering for himself or somebody else, it seemed. All after me. I wondered where the devil so many men came from. The streets were full and everybody hollering. Some going one way and some another way. Some fighting. Here came Mexican John with his knife out and sleeves rolled up to the elbow and ready for fight. Albert continued illustrating his journals. In September, Albert sketched the Prowers Ranch, located 12 miles below Fort Lyon. In October, Bent's Fort, and in November, Old Fort Lyon. In early 1875, his two-page map of Bent County depicted rivers, creeks, ranches, towns, and forts. By 1875, the cattle industry boomed in the lower Arkansas River Valley. Partners Charles Goodnight, John Ho, and Prowers established a slaughterhouse in West Los Animas that year. Goodnight later ranched in the Texas Panhandle. Prowers depended upon Albert. Due to the ranch's great size and available mailing posts, Prowers wrote Albert a letter on September 2, 1876, requesting him to gather wayward cattle wandering near Kiowa, Elbert County. I think you and one of the boys had better come to Jones' camp, and there two of his men will come along with you and drive back everything south of Kiowa. I think the best thing would be to come to Kiowa and hunt this way and gather everything and drive back. And when that is done, come on toward the river, driving what scattering ones you find. And when you get here, we will rig up an outfit and make a drive back. Let me know how the cattle are doing. Write me what you think of the prospects of holding them. Do they try to go up or down the creek? Albert visited family for Christmas in Kansas City in 1880 and received a letter from Prowers dated December 20th. Adverse weather conditions had caused livestock deaths on the ranch's northern boundary. Boys are picking up a few steers and calves on the north side. They went down yesterday, but today I hear the snow is 12 inches deep. I don't think the boys can do anything but take care of the horses. We lost two head. The white pony, 70, that Cliff rode, and the bay Hossa, little raven horse, that Carter rode this summer. Also one mare on the range. I lost 12 saddle horses from mares. Malloy lost 5 horses, and a lot of stock horses has died on Jones' range. By 1884, Prowers owned vast ranch lands and farmland. During one autumn count, his cattle herd had numbered around 70,000. Sadly, Albert's benefactor, only 46, died February 14, 1884. Albert worked for Prowers, or Prowers business managers, for almost 15 years, and then farmed in Macon, Missouri, where he died in 1931. The Mostey brothers had answered when the West called and the Santa Fe Trail beckoned. Bent and Powers had promoted a supply network for those who came after them along the Santa Fe Trail. Kenyon Bennett grew up on ranches in Lampasas County, Texas, and writes about Old West history. Her current long-term projects focus on cattle drives and a circuit-riding preacher from Lampasas County. She is the features coordinator and journalist for two newspapers in southwestern Wisconsin. And now from True West's Ask the Marshal column, published January 2001, here are a few questions to Marshal Trimble. Is it true that Brushy Bill, who claimed to be Billy the Kid, also claimed to be in the James Gang? Lucas Spear, Walton Creek, Texas. Brushy Bill, an old-timer from Hico, Texas, claimed to anyone who would listen that he was a member of the James Gang. Later, he changed his story to say that he was actually Billy the Kid. He died in 1950, and few scholars or knowledgeable researchers believe either claim. Did John Wesley Hardin really go up against Wild Bill Hickok and make him back down? Michael Levine, Boston, Massachusetts. Not likely. That story was told by Hardin, and he was able to spread manure around almost as well as Hickok. Neither was a paragon of honesty when it came to describing their bold deeds. Confrontations between legendary gunfighters were as rare as horseflies in December. Mutual respect probably had a lot to do with it, along with the fear of running up against someone a little bit better. Does a so-called 10-gallon hat really hold 10 gallons? Robert Young, Star Valley, Arizona. Like many other words corrupted from the Spanish language, such as dar le vueltas, dolly welter, to dolly, la riata, to lariat, to vaquero, to buckaroo, gallon is a corrupted word that derives from galon, which means braided. Mexican sombreros had fancy horsehair braided hat bands and used the term su sombrero galoneado to describe their hats. The Texans customarily wore high-crowned hats they fondly referred to as John B's for the maker John B. Stetson. The hat was known as the boss of hats. They adopted the Mexican custom of fancy braided hat bands. That, along with the size, just naturally evolved into the 10-gallon hat. How many men did Judge Isaac Parker, the hanging judge of Fort Smith, Arkansas, actually hang? Bert Smith, Atlanta, Georgia. In his so-called Court of the Damned, Judge Parker administered suspended sentences to 88, all men. He sentenced 168 men and 4 women to hang, but only 88 men made the journey to the massive scaffold at Fort Smith. White House commutations spared 43. In 1889, the Supreme Court began allowing appeals, and Judge Parker's numbers dropped, no pun intended. "I never hanged them," he said. "The law did." What was the usual bounty for an outlaw, wanted dead or alive? Jim Ledbetter, Austin, Texas. $500 was a common amount for bringing a man in dead or alive. That was a lot of money during the post-Civil War years. Marshal Trimble is Arizona's official historian. His books include Arizona, A Cavalcade of History, A Roadside History of Arizona, and Never Give a Heifer a Bum Steer.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Eyes on Success at 1. On this week's Texas Monthly Archives, we're reading articles featuring the world-famous Chicken Ranch. So we're following in that same theme with our audio-described movie, Saturday Night.
Texas has a whorehouse in it.
The hospitality and friendliness never changed, and neither did Miss Woola Jean's strict set of rules. She liked her ladies, as she called them, to treat her customers real good, but never in an unladylike way. It wasn't always easy in them days to come up with hard cash.
Well, you just keep that in the bag and I'll take it out back as soon as we're finished.
So for a while, as the story goes, the girls begin accepting poultry in trade. And that's how the place got its name, the Chicken Ranch.
It's just a village, but no-time country place. Nothing too high tone, just lots of goodwill and maybe one small thrill, but there's nothing dirty going on.
So you know how hard this is for me to say. I love you. Will you marry me?
Oh, Ed Earl, I've loved you since I was 16 years old. But I've thought about this for a long time. And as much as I'd love for it to work, I know deep down in my heart it ain't never going to be.
And I will always love you. I will always love you.
Dolly Parton, Burt Reynolds, Jim Nabors, and Dom DeLuise star in